Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of the tormented Middle East as turmoil in Egypt continues and a possibly disastrous endgame involving the use of weapons of mass destruction in Syria looms. Egyptian-born veteran New York Times and Wall Street Journal Middle East correspondent Yusuf Ibrahim joins us to discuss the demise of democracy and the rise of fundamentalism as the Arab Spring is now being referred to as the Arab Winter. Then we go to Palestine and talk with Mark Danner, who is a journalist and professor and a longtime writer for The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books, where he has an article in the last issue, The Politics of Fear, and an article in the latest issue, How and What Obama Won. We will discuss the triumphant return of the Hamas leader to Gaza and the upcoming reconciliation talks with Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Then finally, we'll speak with Ann Peterman, who is the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, who has been attending UN climate conferences since 2004, but was banned from the UN climate conference in Doha that just ended. We will discuss the scant progress made where the Kyoto protocols were extended to 2020, but no reduction in greenhouse gases was agreed to, in spite of the desperate pleas from the island nations who are disappearing as a result of global warming. And joining us now is Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yusuf Ibrahim.
Hi, good afternoon.
And Yusuf, you're in touch with Egypt, obviously, and you've been there recently. But of course, when you go there, they give you a hard time, don't they, the immigration authorities?
Well, for the longest time, the previous regime basically gave me a very hard time. A hard time means you got to go wait for 2 hours until three separate organizations at the airport check you out. But I suspect the new regime eventually is going to give all of us who categorize themselves as liberal thinkers or liberals in general a much harder time. They're already giving a very hard time to the Egyptian people.
And it looks like Morsi, in reversing himself on his power grab decrees, is nevertheless sticking to insisting on this referendum on December 15. Now, what's disturbing about it is that the liberal secular opposition that you clearly would sympathize with, Yusuf, they're going to boycott, at least they're threatening to boycott the vote, and that will mean that the Muslim Brotherhood will vote in lockstep and the new constitution will go into play. I mean, isn't that political suicide?
Which is pretty much what happened the last time, as a matter of fact. I mean, we got to keep things in perspective. Morsi won by 51 to 49. That's well within the margin of error, but in the next referendum, the Muslim Brotherhood, to begin with, will have actual control of the government, so they will have a more active presence at the voting stations that's beyond simply opening a voting station, but perhaps manipulating the vote, which is the fear of the liberals anyway, or their suspicions, whether they are right or wrong. I tend to think they probably are right. Secondly, which means they concluded there's no way they're going to win anyway. However, your question is a very elegant question. Is the answer to boycott and therefore surrender? There is no question. You have to think about this, and they are thinking. Among the Egyptian opposition front, which has now united, which is, from their point of view, of course, a good thing. From the point of view of the Islamists, it is an outside conspiracy, as always. And they have united around the view that no matter what Morsi says, he has broken all the promises before. The Muslim Brotherhood had said it would never run a person for president in a trend Morsi. It has said it would never control more than 30% of parliament, and it went for 70% of parliament. So basically, the credibility of the Muslim Brotherhood with the Egyptian population is diminishing. The violence and the clashes have further diminished this. And we are standing on the verge of an irreconcilable conflict between two wings of Egyptian society. The surprise in this, Ian, is we just didn't know there were that many liberals in Egypt. It's absolutely amazing. We always assumed that only the Muslim Brotherhood had a militia, had an underground organization, because they've been working on it for 60 years. And suddenly we are discovering that many secular Muslims, not to mention some 10 to 12 million Christians, not to mention other minorities in Egypt, liberal thinkers and writers and the artistic community, et cetera, are also a large number.
Well, the other factor, though, in terms of the conservative Islamist bloc in Egypt, there is, of course, this other factor which came out of nowhere in the parliamentary elections, and that's the Salafist groups. That was largely funded by Saudi Arabia. And one of the things that I find extraordinary here is that you have, as we get towards an end game in Syria that could turn extremely bloody and may even involve the uses of chemical weapons of mass destruction. We don't quite know how that's going to end, but it is a proxy war between Saudi Arabia, this peculiar hybrid of a kleptocracy and a theocracy that have influenced Egyptian politics for the worst. And they're up against the Iranian theocracy, which is a kind of hybrid of a theocracy and a military and intelligence dictatorship. They're flying arms into Syria around the clock as the opposition, the Free Syrian Army, move in on the airport to try and stop them. So I see this whole region being torn apart by these two malignant powers, the Iranians and the Saudi Arabians.
Yeah, it's a little bit like dancing in panic over a hot tin roof that's getting hotter and hotter, or choosing to jump off the building and die anyway. And that's basically where the entire Arab world seems to be today. There is a collection of countries, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, but most especially the tiny emirate of Qatar and Kuwait, who are actually funding the Islamist forces in the Arab world. It's reminiscent in many ways of what we, the United States of America, did back in Afghanistan, back during the, or immediately after the beginning of the Soviet invasion. We picked these people who became eventually the Taliban. We trained them. They were illiterate. They didn't know anything. They were fighting with Lee Enfield, World War I rifles, and we transformed them into an insurgency that was so effective it killed maybe 40,000 Russians and kicked the Russians out. However, in the end of the day, they were only faithful to what they believed, which was an extremist form of Islam, and they turned against us, against the Americans. Now, they are in the process of killing as many Americans as possible, and when the Americans leave, they will take over the country. So the Saudis, especially, and the Qataris, these are the two main bankers for the Islamist movement, are not appreciating the fact that the Islamist movement is an opportunist political organization. It is not a religious organization. It's essentially a group of parties and people and forces who are using Islam as a gateway, a door into power. And it believes really in one vote, one time, forever. So basically, they will turn against those who are being funded, eventually will turn their struggle against the Saudis. For example, in Syria today, the force that is rising is Islamic fundamentalist. It is the Muslim Brotherhood. In Tunisia, which led the Arab Spring, Al-Nahda Party, which is the extreme Islamist party there, claimed in the beginning that it will stay out of the election. Right now, it is pretty much taken over all the political forces and is struggling to take more. In Egypt, we see, of course, that the Muslim Brotherhood turned out to spread their wings far beyond where they said they were going to keep them. In Sudan, we've had an Islamist president for 30 years who's opened the country to Osama bin Laden, to other Islamist groups to train. And in Syria, as I said, the Muslim Brotherhood is in the lead. and has chemical weapons or is trying to obtain those chemical weapons, which will be a game changer. And finally, in Libya, you know, they just killed the American ambassador and three other diplomats, and the country is in total chaos with mostly Islamic groups. So basically, we have one big headline here. What is political Islam? Political Islam is Islamism, as we have come to call it. It's kind of the new communism. It's a new ideological political movement. It is not a religious reformist movement in any form or shape. It has no respect for the rights of individuals and certainly no respect for the rights of women. Now, you have in the middle of this salad, this mix, you have Iran and Iraq, too, who fought an 8-year war, and this war ended up with the creation of a Shiite arc. That's what the King of Jordan coined that phrase. And the Shia, as opposed to Sunni Muslims, is a formidable force on its own. But with two countries the size of Iran and Iraq, Iran's 80 million people run by mullahs, it is a theocracy, and Iraq, a country of a vast majority of Shiites, although not run by a theocracy, pretty sympathetic, combating all the other forces. They are anti-American, and they are, above all, anti-Sunni. So you have this huge cocktail blender here, which is running at medium to full force now. And the truth is, we don't really know what's going to come out of this, but we do know that it's taken already 2 years. We do know that it has destroyed any hope of true democracy in those countries of the Arab Spring. And we do know that it's becoming very bloody in different degrees. In Syria, 40,000 people have been killed already. During the Iraq-Iran War from 1980 to 88, 1 million Muslims were killed by other Muslims. So basically, there is a huge war within Islam, which is spilling over to affect other countries and eventually is uniting in a general rejection of modernization and Western values. So I'd say we are at a historic moment. I don't think any of us who, you know, is 50 years or older has ever imagined that the Middle East would turn this way. And everybody who was 50 years or younger had never even seen anything that resembles democracy. I mean, so they're moving from one autocracy of army officers and generals to another autocracy of imams, sheikhs, and the bearded ones.
Again, I'm speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for the Wall Street Journal. So this deadly cocktail that you're talking about in the region, Yusuf Ibrahim, is certainly coming to a head in Syria as we speak, where the Free Syrian Army, and because the U.S., I think, has been unsure, they haven't been sure of what to do, but they've been sure of what they don't want to happen, but they haven't been clear about what they want to happen. So the Saudis and the Qataris, again, it's difficult to know whether it's official state policy or whether just a bunch of independent wealthy princes are giving money to the Islamists. But we pretty much, it looks a bit like Jihad-EU, a jihadi university there in terms of who the Free Syrian Army are, even though the Syrian people are very secular from my understanding. And then you got the Iranians flying in around the clock, and I believe they've even got the Quds people and the IRGC people on the ground helping Assad fight the Free Syrian Army. It's all coming to a head over the airport in Damascus. What's your expectation of this, also this sword of Damocles that's involved here? This, I think, what is it, over 1,000 tons of sarin and mustard and other nerve gases.
Yes, and guess who is the most worried party of all this? Is the one party I neglected to mention, but is actually the main party in this game, is Israel. Because in the end of the day, if all of these people, the Sunnis, the Shiites, the Jihadists, the Saudis, the the Qataris agree on is that they hate Jews. And the Hamas leader gave a major speech in Gaza yesterday that reminded us that we were back all the way back in the 1970s or 60s, calling for the complete liberation of all of Palestine and Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and so on and so forth. So basically the ascent of radicalism among radical forces is like a genie that has gone out of the bottle now. We spent the last 20 years, we, the United States of America, spent the last 30 years or even more since the Carter administration, trying to ensure and nail down and affirm the basis of an Arab-Israeli peace anchored around the main states that were involved in the conflict, meaning Egypt, which signed the peace treaty with Israel under our sponsorship, and Jordan, which again, under American sponsorship, signed a peace treaty. Syria simply accepted a peace treaty without saying it's a peace treaty, and not a single shot was ever directed from Syria towards Israel for 40 years since the Israelis occupied the Golan Heights. So basically, that structure for us, the United States of America, is the only vital interest we have in that region. Of course, the other vital interest is oil. But as you know, and everybody has been reading lately, we are liberating ourselves increasingly from the need of importing oil from the Middle East. We're discovering tons of natural gas in this country, and Canada is a gusher in terms of oil. And the United States basically is close to the point where oil from the Middle East is no longer a vital interest. But the peace treaty with Israel and the safety of Israel is a vital interest. And where the Obama administration stands on this is exactly what you said. I don't think they know what to do. They know what not to do, which is Obama does not want to get into another war. But you can say these things, and in the end, you have to remember the experience we had in Rwanda. I mean, Clinton sat there and watched a massacre, a genocide, and at the end, he acted. Same thing in Bosnia. America just, you know, cannot, is a superpower. It is the superpower. It cannot stand and watch a massacre expanding in scale without acting. The question is, why don't we have a plan? Why doesn't the National Security Council sit down and work something out? Why are we not hearing that some kind of plan is being prepared? Not a war necessarily, but how to limit the damage, to re-clarify our relationship with Israel, because it's entirely possible that Israel will, the next time it is showered with rockets, will invade Gaza, especially that Hamas now is talking openly about eliminating Israel from existence. So a war is coming. What war? We don't know. It could be the implosion of Syria, which becomes the new Libya with a bunch of crazy militias running around, most of them Islamists with weapons, endless supplies of weapons, drawing the Iraqis in to fight with the Shia against the Sunni. Libya, God knows where this is going. And there are still countries that are in the balance, i.e. Algeria and Morocco. We don't really know which way they are going to be affected by all this. We are looking at a general area that's in flames. I don't know that we can put out the fire, but at least we should have a plan to contain it.
Well, just in closing, then, Yusuf Ibrahim, is there a possibility that in desperation, as the Free Syrian Army closes in on the Assads and the Alawites, is it possible that the Assads will fire their Scud, their chemical-tipped Scud missiles at Israel like Saddam did in the Gulf War?
I think it's a very strong possibility, and that's basically, the follow-up of what I was saying just before. Once this happens, Ian, all bets are off, because the Israelis, do not have but two options. They can accept to be obliterated or deeply, deeply wounded with these chemical weapons. You know, we're talking about serious weapons here. They're much bigger in impact, in real impact, than Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bomb in terms of their impact. How many people will be diseased, will be infected, will die? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people if the Syrians went crazy. That the Syrians are going to go crazy is a safe bet. I would bet my money on that. The man has completely lost any hope of prevailing, that's Bashar al-Assad, and in the same time is losing any opportunity of getting out safely. So basically we are heading there for a no-return revenge. He's killed far too many people to be forgiven or allowed a safe exit. I don't think even the Russians can continue to support him. So it is entirely possible that Bashar al-Assad will unlock the key to not an atomic war, but something pretty close to that in the Middle East.
Well, Yusuf Ibrahim, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is a columnist and political risk consultant. He served for 18 years as senior regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times and 6 years as energy editor for The Wall Street Journal. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Palestine and talk with Mark Danner.
This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end, no safety or surprise, the end.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. He's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books. He teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo and the Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. He has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, The Politics of Fear, and the forthcoming issue, How and What Obama Won. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be here.
I can't tell you how good it is to hear your voice after we've been struggling to get through to you live.
I'm sorry you've had trouble.
No, I know. It turned out we had to call you via Israel. The Palestinian numbers weren't working. But I'm glad we're talking to you. You are in the West Bank. Of course, I don't know whether you were in Gaza with the triumphant return a couple of days ago of Khaled Mashal, which was an extraordinary event. Let's start with that. What's the sense there of course, the idea that he reiterated Hamas's rejection of Israel's existence, but he did also, he's apparently due for reconciliation talks with his rival Fatah, the Palestinian Authority. So let's start with Gaza. Did you witness any of this or did you watch it on TV?
No, I wasn't in Gaza. I'm in the West Bank right now in Ramallah. So this West Bank, as your listeners I'm sure know, is governed by the Palestinian Authority, by President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Salim Fayyad. And the reconciliation that has been talked about, of course, is between Mashal and Hamas, which rules Gaza, and Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. People have heard about reconciliation talks before, of course. In fact, there's an agreement signed months and months ago that supposedly represented a reconciliation between the two bodies. nothing has really come of that. So I think there's a general skepticism about what actually will emerge. I mean, people are will be willing to believe it when they see it. It's a strange atmosphere here now in the West Bank. There is, as you mentioned, a sense, a good degree of, or a sense of triumph in Gaza. The notion's been put about that Hamas won the recent war or semi-war with Israel by getting them to agree to certain concessions, opening up slightly the roads into Gaza. The sea borders have been loosened somewhat. More broadly, you had a kind of redefinition of the regional forces, which I think is much more important. That is that the Egyptians essentially came to Hamas's rescue and reaffirmed that the Arab Spring had a decisive effect on regional diplomacy. That is, you no longer have a Mubarak sitting in Cairo willing to back the Israelis and punish Hamas. You suddenly have a regime, a Muslim Brotherhood regime under Mr. Morsi, that really sees Hamas as their brother organization. You know, they came from the same roots. So from the beginning of this conflict, you had the Egyptian prime minister visiting as the bombs were falling on Gaza. He came and visited Gaza. You had the Tunisian foreign minister. You had the Turkish foreign minister. You had a delegation from the Arab League. I mean, this is completely new in regional politics. Usually there's lip service given to the Palestinian cause, but very little action taken. And I think the Israelis were rather shocked by this, by the pushback. And it led them not to, though I saw the enormous buildup of tanks and other equipment right around Gaza and southern Israel, they did not, as so many Israelis wanted, by the way, they did not intervene on the ground. And I think this was perceived certainly by Hamas and many Palestinians as a kind of victory. But I wouldn't say that there is a sense of euphoria here or a sense of optimism. The situation remains quite grim. You know, the last substantial agreement was Oslo in 93, which promised a Palestinian state no later than 1999. And you've recently had the announcement from the Israelis that there would be zoning and the beginning of development of the so-called Area E1, which is a chunk of the West Bank surrounding Jerusalem, which in effect would cut the West Bank in two and really doom any notion, any real practical notion of a two-state solution. So, you know, they're very mixed feelings. I'd like to, you know, talk about triumph, but I think that isn't really the tone here. There's a long way to go for any substantial progress to be made.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Denner, longtime writer, journalist, and professor, a staff writer for The New Yorker, regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, where he has an article, The Politics of Fear, and a forthcoming article, How and What Obama Won. He's in the West Bank. Mark, it would seem, though, that the fact that the focus is on Hamas, that they're feeling triumphant every time they have a war with Israel and get trounced, they nevertheless end up basically celebrating victory, and it all makes the Palestinian Authority look irrelevant and look somewhat castrated. I don't know it's medically possible to have multiple castrations, but how much more can Abu Mazen stand?
Well, the multiple castration line is sadly appropriate, whether it's medically possible or not. The fact is that the Israelis have now, of course, in addition to saying that one of the consequences, you know, the move to the UN, because Abbas, of course, went to the UN and was granted non-observer status at the UN, that the Israelis are punishing that on the one hand by talking about the development of E1, on the other hand by the building of, I think, 3,000 new housing units on the West Bank, and on the third hand, talk about medically impossible, on the third hand, cutting off tax payments. This is money that the Palestinians actually pay, that Israel collects. They're going to cut off these payments to the Palestinian Authority. And essentially, if they do that, the Palestinian Authority will collapse and won't have any more money. The sad thing, of course, when you say castration, I mean, the PA essentially is viewed by many on the West Bank simply as a kind of handmaiden of the Israelis. It handles security. It polices the West Bank within Area A's Area A, which is Palestinian populated cities. It serves as a security force, and it does it in collaboration with the Israelis. So the Israelis, in sort of trying to cut off the funds, are really doing themselves, as so often in this conflict, they're wounding themselves. I mean, they're essentially dealing themselves a blow because their security is ensured by the Palestinian Authority, which is one of the reasons why the PA is so unpopular here. It's by many people, it's simply viewed as the kind of handmaiden of the Israelis. And now the Israelis will cut off their money. The PA may conceivably collapse, although the Arab League today voted, as your listeners may have seen, voted to replace that money. We'll see if they actually do it. But the Israelis, often do this. They kind of take measures against actions by the PA that in effect hurt themselves, the Israelis, and they're threatening to do that now. But as you say, Gaza and Hamas has now scored a considerable victory at the expense of the popularity of the Palestinian Authority, which is very low to begin with.
Clearly, the role of Egypt has always been important since Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood and now in power in Egypt, although obviously there's a tremendous amount of pushback from the very people who brought about the revolution in Egypt that toppled the Mubarak regime. They're very unhappy with the power grab of Morsi's. He today said he backpedaled on some of his decrees, but nevertheless wants to go ahead with the referendum that the opposition are going to boycott, making it more likely that a Muslim Brotherhood constitution will come into effect. So Egypt is going to go through a long and tortured period. Morsi came out of those talks that settled the latest mini war between Israel and Gaza. He settled the deal with Hillary Clinton, and Morsi came out looking good, and then promptly issued the decree, grabbing power. Right. But a part of the decree, what I find interesting is that apparently the U.S. Contingency in the Sinai is going to be increased, and the idea that you've got this lawless badlands in the Sinai where a lot of the rockets coming in from Sudan, with the Israelis recently bombed from Iran via Sudan smuggled into the Sinai, that the U.S. are going to be policing this lawless land, going after jihadis. That's a two-edged sword, isn't it? The jihadis want to kill Americans. So if you put more Americans in the Sinai, isn't that going to mean more American deaths?
Well, it's possible. It's possible. It presumably will also give the Egyptians more of an incentive to keep those people out. So I don't know whether you'll see more America deaths. I mean, the fact is that we've now entered a period, as you pointed out pretty well, of significant instability in Egypt. These things, obviously the Gaza situation, the Egyptian situation, the Sinai situation that you've just described, are all linked very tightly. Morsi moved forward on his decrees, no doubt in part because he scored a considerable political victory in negotiating the Gaza peace, looked like a great peacemaker and key figure in the region. He also, of course, that morning, I think, or the morning before, signed a $5 billion agreement with the IMF, another triumph. So he was feeling politically very strong, and he clearly overstepped in issuing the decree he did. On the other hand, the opposition is in a peculiar situation where they cannot hope. I mean, they're in a game where the key to the game is votes, and they are not in a situation where they can win when it comes to votes. And it's a very difficult situation to be in, particularly when a substantial number of them are Democrats. So they're trying to take him out of power in the street after he's been elected, and after he has passed a constitution, which by all indications is a shoo-in to win. that is to win, to be passed and ratified by referendum. So, you know, I think we're in for a period of increasing political instability there. There's no real solution to that problem. When you have a democratic game in which none of the opposition parties really has a chance to win in the democratic game, you end up having politics of the street. Whether there will be deaths of Americans or not, I don't know. I do know that, you know, the Sinai is becoming an increasing flashpoint. And, of course, you know, troop movements in the Sinai and rules about what you can do in the Sinai and security in the Sinai are a key part of the Camp David Accords of 1979 between Israel and Egypt. And that is essentially the red line in the relationship between Israel and Egypt. Will the Egyptians, you know, now under a Muslim Brotherhood government, continue to observe all the provisions of that peace treaty? That's a red line for the Israelis, and that's a red line for the Americans. So we're in very delicate territory. I mean, up to now, Morsi certainly has. But one wonders at what point the Israelis find themselves increasingly threatened by what's going on in the Sinai, and what will they do about it?
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who is a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books, where he has two articles in the current issue, The Politics of Fear, and the forthcoming issue, How and What Obama Won. And he's in the West Bank, and we're speaking to him live. Of course, the previous guest we had on, Mark, we talked about not just Egypt, but also Syria, which is really coming to a head. You've just mentioned some red lines for Israel. The U.S. has also issued red lines over the use of chemical weapons. The opposition, the Free Syrian Army, is closing in on the airport to try and shut down the flow of arms coming in from Iran. But they're also going after the chemical weapons as well. Our previous guest suggested that Assad is crazy and cornered and ruthless, and it wouldn't be a complete surprise if chemical weapons were used. And it, furthermore, it would not be a total surprise if Assad struck out at Israel with scuds with chemical weapons on them in the way that Saddam Hussein struck out at Israel during the Gulf War. To change the subject, if you will. So, what's the sense in the region there that this could really turn into the ultimate nightmare, which is the use of weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I didn't hear Yusuf's, you know, fully elaborated argument. I just heard the last few words of it. I think the scenario of Assad attacking Israel with chemical weapons seems far-fetched to me. I mean, we are entering an area here in the final days of at least the first phase of this conflict, which is what it seems, where anything could happen. I mean, it's clear that the regime, I agree, Assad has proved himself ruthless. There's no question about that. I don't know if he's crazy. The regime is clearly fighting for its life. It's done it by using artillery systematically and the Air Force as well on cities and towns. We're told lately that there is activity at these bases in which chemical weapons are either being moved or possibly being prepared. That was the leak to the New York Times. President Obama has said that this is one of our red lines, although I believe the first, you know, the Times detailed this the other day, that the first red line he announced, which was before the election, I think it was in August, was that, you know, the red line was if these things were moved. I think the administration has now backed off that and said the red line is if they were used. I'm not sure what exactly the administration would do about that, frankly. I mean, its options are not, it's not as if it has a lot of options. I don't think they want to intervene in any way on the ground in this fight. It's an enormous mess, and the American people would not support it. I mean, there is not any appetite for another ground war in the Middle East. So what would they do? You cannot bomb chemical weapons depots effectively. because you essentially you can't be sure of destroying them. There's no way to be sure that you're not going to activate them and cause secondary deaths by bombing them. So it's a very difficult problem. By the same token, chemical weapons are very horrible. I've always resisted a little bit that phrase "weapons of mass destruction" because I think it joins together several different weapons that are very different. Nuclear weapons, for one, which we're not talking about. Chemical weapons are terrible, no question about it. But whether their use in Syria would mean a kind of apocalypse, which is what many people are talking about, I'm not so sure. Saddam Hussein used them in Kurdistan. He killed, 3,000, 4,000 people. Again, it was very terrible. But the end of days did not come. I think if Assad used these weapons on civilians, there would be the kind of worldwide reaction that perhaps the Syrian leadership still would not, would fear enough that they would avoid taking that step. It may be that they're mixing the weapons or moving them as some kind of signal to the West that they should intervene to stop this conflict. That is, I'm not sure that we should take this. We should not take the leak of this movement on these bases. I'm not sure we shouldn't take it with a bit of a grain of salt. That is, it may not speak completely for itself. It may be about, in some way, signaling and trying to force some kind of action from the Russians, for example, or from the Iranians. I don't know. I honestly don't know. But I think Yousef is certainly right that it is possible for this to spiral out of control in a very horrible way. The fact is that more than any other conflict arising out of the so-called Arab Spring, the Syrian civil war involves area forces in a very inextricable and dangerous way. You have the Iranians as the main sponsor of the Assad regime, with Iraq, our supposed ally, helping. You have the Saudis and other Gulf countries supporting the Sunni insurgents in Syria. So you have, in effect, within Syria, a kind of hot war expressing the so-called Arab Cold War between the Saudis and the Iranians. And whenever you have a war like that, in which the local players are in part representatives of larger forces, there's a danger it can spin out of control in a very bloody way.
Well, Mark, I thank you so much for joining us from Palestine and for giving us your up-to-date report on what's happening in that tortured and tumultuous region.
My pleasure. It's good to be with you, Ian, and I'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. He's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books. He teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. He has two articles in The New York Review of Books, The Politics of Fear in the Current Issue, and How and What Obama Won in the Forthcoming Issue. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the UN climate conference that just ended empty-handed.
Did it all get real? I guess it's real enough. They got refrigerators full of blood. Another century spent pointing guns at anything that moves. Sometimes I worry that I've lost the plot. My twitching muscles tease my flipping thoughts. I never really dreamed of heaven much.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Ann Peterman, the Executive Director of the Global Justice Ecology Project and the coordinator of the International Stop Genetically Engineered Trees campaign. She's been attending the UN climate conferences annually since 2004, including organizing protests and civil disobedience, several of them to protest the shutting out of the voices of communities impacted by climate change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ann Peterman.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the talks that just concluded in Doha, the UN climate talks extending the Kyoto protocols, you were banned from this year's talks, right?
That's true, yes. We, for doing unpermitted civil disobedience the last 2 years, the UN said, well, we actually don't want you to come this year. So we got a letter from the executive secretary telling us we were not allowed to attend this year.
Well, that doesn't disqualify you from talking about it, though, surely. And I'm hoping we can do a summary of what was achieved or not achieved. And what this telling us, the UN climate talks in Doha, achieved an historic shift in principle, even though they admit that there were few genuine cuts in greenhouse gases. But they're arguing that for the first time, rich nations have to move towards compensating poor nations for losses due to climate change. Is that an achievement to your mind?
They didn't actually get an agreement on that. They agreed to talk about it some other time in the future, but they didn't really make an agreement. The U.S. led a block of developed countries in saying, no, we actually don't want to take any responsibility for the historic impacts from climate change that are causing such massive damage in the developing countries. So they didn't really get that, unfortunately.
So they're extending the Kyoto protocols to 2020, even though all the big players really aren't on board, except, you know, the EU and Australia. And the Australian government, of course, will be facing an election soon, and the Conservatives are like the American Republicans who don't believe that climate change is real. So that Australia's likely to drop out with the next government, assuming the Labor government in Australia is not re-elected. The small island nations basically are, you know, they're up against the huge big players, right? The U.S. and China and India.
Exactly. I mean, when you go to these things, you see the power imbalance, you know, not only the big countries versus the small countries, the industrialized countries versus the so-called developing countries, but also the official negotiators versus the observers, you know, the people, the groups like ours and the Indigenous Peoples Organizations and all of these other groups who have vested interest in what's going on and have absolutely no ability to participate in the decision-making.
So the final text of the agreement that was made in Doha to extend the Kyoto Protocols to 2020, the text encourages, that's the key word, encourages rich nations to mobilize up to $10 billion a year up to 2020 to help offset the effects of climate change on the poorer nations. Now, there's no way in the world that the United States is in a political position to talk about, giving money to poor nations. I mean, we're in a situation where our political authorities and our press have convinced us that we're going broke, which of course is a huge lie with this nonsense over the fiscal cliff. Give us a sense of America's position here, because it seems pretty ironic that the U.S. hasn't signed on, even though, of course, the presidents have wanted to sign on. It's largely because of the U.S. Senate has refused to go along with Kyoto from the beginning. But President Obama didn't really make an issue out of it in the campaign. But at the same time, the president, in his stimulus package, which is before part of this fiscal cliff nonsense, is in there. The $60 billion is in there because of the damage done by Hurricane Sandy to New York and New Jersey. And that's a de facto admission that climate change is real, isn't it? So how much has the U.S. been called out on this?
Oh, the U.S. gets called out every single year at these climate conventions. They are by far the number one obstruction to any positive action at these events. They're not alone by any means. They've got Canada right next to them and New Zealand and other countries that are very well known for their obstructionism. And now you have, of course, China, which has got this enormously growing economy, not wanting to jeopardize that, so that, you know, they're also causing their own set of problems. But, you know, the U.S. from the beginning has been the greatest obstacle to legally binding climate action on a global level.
So the fact that President Obama is asking Congress for $60 billion because of Hurricane Sandy was an issue at this talk, in these climate talks in Doha.
Well, sure. I mean, you've got all of these developing countries saying, hey, what about us? You know, look at what's just happened in the Philippines with the typhoon that just slammed into them. I mean, 100% damage in some regions, you know, 600 people dead, 900 people missing, and the typhoon is now getting ready to come back and hit the Philippines again. And these are countries that don't have a big coffer to be able to help the poor on the coastal regions rebuild or move inland further or whatever, the mitigation that needs to happen to avoid climate catastrophes in the future. So, yeah, these are the countries on the front lines of experiencing what's happening with climate change and have, you know, almost no resources to address it. And so they're saying, hey, you know what, the United States has the historical responsibility here. They're the ones who put the majority of the climate change gases into the atmosphere. They're the ones who should be helping mitigate the impacts that countries are now experiencing. And there's just no, as you said, there's no political will. There's no indication that that's ever going to happen.
But I guess you can't entirely blame the Obama administration, in as much as one political party here, the Republicans, and they do control the House and they obstruct all progress in the Senate. They're effectively committed to denying the very existence of global warming.
Well, I can't say that Obama's, you know, really on board with the picture either, the program either. I mean, he's approved offshore drilling in the Arctic. You know, he's going crazy for fracking. I mean, you know, he's Mr. Fossil Fuel Development, and the U.S. is on track to surpass Saudi Arabia by 2020 as the world's largest oil producer. So, you know, we're not exactly moving in the right direction under the Obama administration.
Well, but is there a difference then, to your mind, between acknowledging that we have a problem and denying that we have a problem?
One would hope so. I'm just saying that it hasn't played out as far as any kind of programmatic reality under Obama at this point, even in his own, you know, what he is himself doing. He's not really actually taking it seriously.
Well, that's pretty apparent from these talks that neither the United States, China, Russia, India, you know, the only people who appear to be taking it seriously are the victims, the small island nations, and the Europeans and the Australians.
Well, and that's what's so ironic is, as we see the weather intensifying, I mean, at this point, the average global temperature rise has been about 0.8 degrees Celsius. And by 2020, it's expected to have exceeded 2 degrees Celsius, which is what scientists say we have to stay under if we want to avoid total climate catastrophe. That's almost three times where we are now. And we've seen what's happened already. You know, Joplin, Missouri was wiped off the map by a tornado, Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy. I mean, you know, what's going to be happening next in the United States in terms of these mega storms? They're only going to be getting worse. So it's not like the United States is exempt from the impacts of climate change. And that's what I find, you know, so utterly bizarre, is that the policies coming out of government just don't even seem to care that it's even its own population that's going to be experiencing the problems from this.
Well, just in closing, Ann Peterman, what do you think can change this dynamic of denial and drill, baby, drill? You know, to some extent, I think perhaps we know, for example, that the Koch brothers, who have been funding a lot of the global denial, and unfortunately the press, to some extent, have been complicitous in global warming denial because of their convention in the press of having equal and opposite arguments, and the global deniers can are making the case that they're just another argument, you know, opposite to the scientific argument, just like the creationists are saying their argument is equal to evolution. So that seems to me to be a problem. But in terms of the oil companies and the Cokes and others investing in junk science to sustain and maintain denial, you would think, for example, that the insurance companies would weigh in now because they've taken a huge hit from Hurricane Sandy. So what gives you hope?
There are more and more people taking this seriously every day. What I'm hoping is that communities can actually start getting together and figuring this out on their own, what steps need to be taken to address this, that we don't continue to wait for the politicians to figure it out. Because as you pointed out, and especially with the Citizens United decision that said that, you know, anonymous entities can dump as much money into the elections as they want to, which, you know, leaves it wide open for the oil companies to control the outcomes pretty much. You know, with all of that, that we need to start looking at alternatives and how we're going to transform this dominant economic system into one that actually is responsive to reality, to what's going on in the public, what's going on in the environment. And that's where I really see hope, is this bottom-up organizing and, you know, not worrying so much what's happening at the top, because these guys are just not going to figure it out for us. The small island nations, I mean, they're really an inspiration, looking at how hard that they've been working to try to get some kind of action to happen that can address their real problems. I mean, these countries are literally going underwater. They're already planning to move their populations elsewhere because they can't have, they're just not going to be in existence for very much longer. But this is not just going to be the small island nations. This is a global phenomenon, and I really believe that globally we as people can figure it out. The Occupy movement, you know, 99% versus the 1%. It's not even really 1%. It's like 0.1%. You know, there's 99.9% of us out there that can figure this out. And, you know, not worry about what the 0.1% are doing, because they really don't matter in the long run.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ann Peterman.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Ann Peterman, who's Executive Director of Global Justice Ecology Project and the coordinator of the International Stop Genetically Engineered Trees campaign. She's been attending the UN climate conferences since 2004, including organizing protests and civil disobedience of several of them to protest the shutting out of the voices of communities impacted by climate change. And she was, and her organization were shut out of the just concluded UN climate talks, extending the Kyoto Protocols that took place in Doha. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and I'll answer your questions. The conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.